break out your wireframes and heat up those Git repos. We're ready to tackle topics ranging from accessibility to front-end design, user experience, and beyond. You're listening to the Drunken UX Podcast with your hosts, Michael Feenan and Aaron Hill. Well, hello everybody, and thank you for joining us on the Drunken UX Podcast. This is episode number 116 for June 6th, 2022. We're going to be talking about JavaScript quirks, and I am your host, Michael Feenan.
And I'm your other host, Aaron, and I have a question for you, Michael.
Hi, Michael. I mean, Aaron. Yes.
What's the U stand for?
User.
Are you sure?
Uther?
You experience.
an old joke. But she checks out, sir. Why? What does the U stand for?
I don't know. I was asking you.
Oh, okay. I thought you were leading into something, but...
No, I it was a lot funnier in my head.
You were setting me up to fall down.
I was setting you up for like the joke. Like a fun gag, and I didn't pull it off.
Right, you didn't warn me first is sort of the problem, right? I'm sitting here with a slice open underneath my eye because I played with my dog a little too rough, and she said, "Michael, back off," and I paid for it. So I'm going to be drinking some whiskey tonight to numb that down just a hair. Hey, everybody. What?
That's a change.
This is the third episode in our series on quizzing each other on different technology. Episode number one was 114, where I tested Aaron on JavaScript. Episode number two was 115, where he tested me on Ruby. And now we're going back to JavaScript, but with another twist. We don't want to just do the same thing over again. So I found a page that had some pretty good questions, at least I thought. And instead, we're both going to do it together. I'm going to be sort of the smart kid at the front of the class, and Aaron's going to be the hooligan behind me who is looking over my shoulder trying to steal my answers. And so we're going to talk through these
distracting
things.
You, because that's more interesting than answering questions.
Yeah, well, that too.
Poking you in the back repeatedly.
Throwing like spitballs at the back of my ear.
Yeah.
Not that it ever happened to me in real school, except that it definitely did. So this is going to be from Dmitry Pavlutin's blog. He's got a series of seven questions lined up, and so we're going to look at those. Before we do that, I do want to talk real fast about what we're drinking. So my painkiller is not an album by 3 Days Grace. It is something a little different. I'm going to show this to you, Aaron, as I'm saying it. It is Amrut. Amrut?
Amrut? Okay.
Indian single malt whiskey.
Interesting.
Bottled at 46%. It's apparently been produced since the 40s. I've never heard of this. I was in our local store, and the owner was like, and I asked him, because he's an Indian gentleman, and I was like, I haven't heard of this. And he's like, oh, no, it's very good. Any Indian restaurant you go to, they're going to have this if they're a good restaurant. And it was cheap. I don't remember what I paid for it, but I think it was under $50. And I was just like, you know what? Let's just see. You know, Japanese single malt is a thing, and it's great. You know, there are other folks even, like, here in the States now that are trying to do, like, variations on the idea of single malt and whatnot. So I thought, hey, I'd give it a chance. Turns out it is actually pretty great. It's not real complex. It's kind of like maybe like a Glenmorangie tin. Just a very simple... young Highland type scotch. It's sort of light and feathery. It doesn't have hardly anything on the nose. That was what struck me real hard with it was, or rather didn't strike me hard when I first opened it.
It's not like it didn't strike you hard.
It didn't strike me hard. I had to like bury my nose in the bottle to like get anything off of it. And it was just like this sort of light floral and like a generic light floral. And the flavor is kind of like that. It's not strong. It's very sort of, you know, yellow grass forward, sweet grass wheats, you know, that grainy flavor kind of comes through, a little bit of that just malt funk that you can get. And that's about it. Like, it's not crazy. Okay. It's warm. It's 46%. So it's at least, you know, it does the job. And pretty inoffensive for the most part. I was surprised. Like I say, not anything that's going to be like an oh my God favorite, like I mentioned last week with the Glenlivet Illicit still. I got this in the same batch as that, though. I was kind of on an adventure, so I just got some stuff. But
okay.
I would not recommend it, and certainly throughout an Indian restaurant, and they have it, I think it's very much worth trying.
All right. I have the same as last week, actually. I have the Kilchoman.
I don't know. You were the one watching the YouTube video. Time. That's one I don't know the right pronunciation on it, so I won't try.
I think it was like Kilchoman or something. It was the accent was on the second syllable. I'm very sorry for butchering your name, Scotch brand. It's good though.
If Gaelic didn't want to be butchered, they should have used less vowels and fewer weird consonants together.
I know the issue with Gaelic was – oh, no, I'm thinking of Welsh. Welsh has too many consonants, right? That's the one it's just
– There's a law, and I don't forget exactly where this is, but in the UK where they have to print their signs in English and Welsh. And kind of like in Quebec, how they do English and French.
Right.
And there's this picture of the sign. And this may be total internet, like, bullshittery as far as I know, but I think it's real. And the sign's got the English on top, which is perfectly normal, and on the bottom is Welsh, which there's no possible way for me to read it. But apparently, whoever put in for the translation sent the email over, they got the email back with the translation, they copied it, pasted it in, and printed the deal. And somebody pointed out that the sign says, whatever it says in English, like, you know, so far to this place, take a right, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's a handful of words. Yeah. And the bottom says, I am out of the office. Please contact me on whatever date. So he got an autoresponder in Welsh and copy and pasted it. So,
oh my god, that's so great!
I mean, it's believable. Like I can say, this could not be. This may not be real, but we know it happens. Like that is not an uncommon thing, especially with like Chinese.
Oh sure.
So
yeah,
like,
sure.
The whole like Google copy and paste and things like that is very real. So it's like I absolutely believe it would happen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it seems very plausible.
Hey, I want to start real fast with a quick bit of news that is super timely because it was super today. And at least today, as in when we're recording, which is just ahead of release. If you keep up on your WordPress news, you might have noticed a press release come out from WP Engine today that they have acquired Delicious Brains.
Yeah, I don't know who Delicious Brains is, though.
They are the purveyors of...
Or what?
They are purveyors...
Okay.
...of... what's the word for like really high end food?
Boutique?
Not boutique. Oh crap!
Premium.
High
quality food?
Highfalutin zombies.
Oh okay.
Or humans rather for zombies. You ever watch the show iZombie? Like it's kind of like that.
iZombie. Okay.
What they also do though, like on the side, it's kind of a black market thing. They make a lot of WordPress plugins. So Delicious Brains, if that name sounds familiar, but you're not quite sure where, they have a whole list of plugins they make. They've done a WP Offload SES, Better Search Replace, WP Offload Media, WP Migrate, and most significantly, ACF, the Advanced Custom Fields plugin, which if you are a WordPress dev, you probably have touched and used at some point.
I've used that one before.
That's pretty big news, Delicious Brains was just acquired like a year ago, if my memory is right, by somebody, or Delicious Brains acquired the people who made, I can't remember the flow, like it's so hard to remember the way all of these things go, but basically all of this stuff exchanged hands a year ago, and now it has happened again with WP Engine picking them up. Good, I think is my initial reaction to that. I trust WP Engine. Without fawning too much, I will preface that by saying I am a WP Engine customer. I use their service. I'm very happy with it. The tools they have built, we've talked about on here, Atlas Content Modeler, the WP Developer Kit. They purchased Local by Flywheel and have made it available for everybody. So thus far, WP Engine has not done anything to sort of, you know, abuse the trust in sort of the WordPress space. They've bought Woo Themes, WooCommerce, the Woo organization is now owned by them, I think. Now I'm trying to remember like all of the different acquisitions over the years. Genesis, they own the Genesis suite. So there's a whole lot going on that they now control. So it will remain to be seen. Like, this is one of those things that it could get a little hinky. You know, if they decided to change posture or position on all of this stuff. But I think for the moment, it's very good. And I think it's good for the plugins. I think it's good for the community. And I'll be interested to see what happens with, like, the pro versions of some of these tools. Because that could be very interesting as well. If, you know, if WP Engine customers might get access to pro versions out of the box. Maybe.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Right now, like, the current, you know, news is no news. It's basically business as usual for all of the things. But, you know, down the road, I think we could certainly see some changes to that model. So that'll be interesting. And it's going to be something to just kind of keep an eye on. And for now, the biggest assurance to everybody is nothing's happening to any of these plugins. They're still available. If you have subscriptions, those will continue as normal. So this is one of those change without change, I think, a little bit for now. And but big news, nonetheless. Like, these things, as they move around, it's kind of interesting to see over time what happens to them. So,
cool.
WordPress news to kick off the night. Okay, so you got your quiz up in front of you.
Did we say the title of it already?
So this is 7 simple but tricky JavaScript interview questions. These are a couple years old, but as far as I know, they're still pretty relevant as far as that goes. I mentioned I had skimmed it, but I did not pay attention to the answers. Aaron is not looking at the answers. And we may totally embarrass ourselves. And I think that'll be pretty damn funny if that happens. So let's see what happens. And let's just kick off with the kickoff, right? So what we got is an accidental global variable. We have a function, foo.
Yes.
And in function foo, we say let a equals b equals 0. Then we a plus plus, which is an incrementer, and then we return a. Then what they do is they run foo, and then they say type of a and type of b. And what will those b be? I have the initial chunk of information, I think.
So
one of these is easy. Which one do you think is the easiest? A or b?
I mean, I would presume A, because it's both the first variable named and also its return.
Okay, so what is the type of A? Or let's start this, right? Well, what are our type options here that would probably make sense?
Oh, God.
Number?
Number.
Boolean.
Not a number. Undefined.
Undefined.
String. String?
While it's an option, there's no string involved in the function.
Right.
So I think we really have three types we could have here, right? We could have a number, we could have a Boolean, we could have an undefined.
All right, so looking at the title, that it's called accidental global variable, I'm presuming that the behavior that it looks like it should be, which is that they should both be undefined, is perhaps not the case. So let's say that maybe A is a number and B is undefined.
Okay. I'm pretty certain on this one that you're backwards.
Really?
A is undefined and B is a number.
What?
So here's the question. Do you trust my answer or do you think I'm wrong?
I'm going to trust your answer in this case,
okay.
But I don't understand it.
Here's why I think it is backwards from what you
said. I'll copy your answer onto my quiz.
So here's the thing. A, I'm 99% certain is undefined. I'm not a 99. I'm 100% certain A is undefined. Because keep in mind, let is a block scoping declaration. So let A, while we are returning A, we aren't returning the variable A. We're only returning the value of it, which is zero. So A itself, if we call a type of outside of the function, that's going to be undefined every time. But here's the thing. B isn't declared. And so in order to execute the expression, let A equal B equal zero, it has to assume that there is a variable B up the scope. And in the absence of one, it will create it, and as a result, it would be a number.
Wow. Okay.
And I am correct.
That it seems ridiculous, but it's like a Ripley's Believe It or Not thing, right? Like, it seems so ridiculous that it's got
to
be true.
Yeah, yeah. No, so here's...
to be clear, I have not looked at the answer. I see the answer heading, but I have not scrolled down that far. So I don't know if you're correct or not.
Yeah, no, I am. I've already scrolled down here. So it says, no variable B is declared, neither in the foo scope or global scope. So JavaScript interprets B equals zero as window.b equals zero. So there you go.
Jesus, man.
So little...
It seems dangerous.
Little funky. That's actually a good deal to know, too, if you are working with multiple variables inside a function, and if you aren't paying attention to, like, your hoisting or things like that, or where in your code variables are being declared, you can both overwrite variables that you don't expect to, or you can create variables that you don't expect to, especially if you're trying to work inside of something like a private function or something like that of a class. You don't, you may not want to expose some of that stuff. So,
Wow.
Okay. All right. So, next second question. Called, array
it's
length.
Called array length property.
Array length property.
And it says, what is the value of close brackets zero?
So that's index zero, which is the first item in an array.
Right. And we have... const clothes equals brackets and then a string jacket, comma, and then a string t-shirt, close bracket, semicolon, and then clothes.length equals zero. And now they want to know what clothes zero is.
So let's go the same route here, right? So clothes zero could be jacket. Could be t-shirt, could be neither, could be both.
Could be undefined.
So then let's...
It could be not a number.
It could be not a number.
Why not?
No, that's fair. You're all right. It could also be not a number. So let's think about close.length, right? So we have a property of an array, close.length. Is that property immutable?
Right, yeah. So is close.length... basically a getter only, or is it like a full accessor?
So yeah, so if we say close.length equals zero, is that changing the property? If changing,
I really want it to be read only.
Yeah,
I'm afraid it's not, but I really want it to be. Am I going to be disappointed?
So you look up at my bubble sheet and you see me filling in the bubble for clothes index zero is undefined.
Wow.
Do you trust me? Do you not?
You
trusted me last time.
Yeah.
Do you want my explanation for why I think it's undefined?
Well, I mean, is your explanation that you can in fact set like the length property?
Let's do that backwards. Let's not go with my rationale. You can't ask me during the test. You see my answer
Right.
Why would you say, if you agree undefined?
You? Right.
How would you justify that answer to yourself?
If I was presuming that you were correct, then my assumption is that dot length does allow read write, even though I think that is just ridiculous.
And so what would be happening in that situation if you set it to zero?
Then, see, all of my assumptions are based on, like, JavaScript behaving like a normal programming language. You know, like, I'm thinking, like, you know, pointers and memory allocation and stuff. And if you're saying that, like, this thing has zero elements, then it's like, you know, resetting the width of the array. Mm-hmm. Is that what happens?
Yes. Seriously? Setting the length to zero truncates the array to that length.
This shit powers, like, a lot of the internet, dude.
Similar to, like, substringing something. Now, if you want to have a weird thing... Now, I'm saying that. That's my understanding of it. I have not scrolled down to the answer yet. But the reason for this, and the thing that will... And why this stands out to me is because dot length is immutable in different circumstances. So, for instance, while you can set the length of an array to zero, and as a result, it will truncate it down, if you had, let's say it was a string, let's say clothes equals jacket, clothes.length would be 5. And if right. you set clothes.length to zero, clothes still equals jacket. It doesn't truncate strings.
Right. Why did they let you change the length of an array via that property?
That is not a question that I can answer, dear sir. All I can tell you is that is how it works.
Huh.
So, and I'm scrolling, yes, and so we are correct. Close zero is undefined because the close array has been emptied. Reducing what they say here from ECMA is reducing the value of the length property has the side effect of deleting own array elements whose array index is between the old and new length values.
Wow.
And that is straight out of ECMA 2015. So, yeah.
That's wild, man.
That one's a little interesting. I think it's especially weird that it truncates on arrays but not on strings. The difference in behavior there is kind of weird, and I'm sure there's a reason for it, but... That is the case. All right, are you ready to keep going? Are you already hurting?
Yes. Yes. No, I'm okay.
Okay. So keep with us.
I'm glad you're sitting in front of me. I'll just say that.
It gets weirder. It gets weirder. What is the content of numbers array? So this is called the eagle eye test, and I have no clue why. So we have a constant length equals 4. So variable length equals 4. We have a constant numbers equals array.
Okay.
We have a for loop. Var I equals 0. And then while I is less than the length, increment or iterate I plus plus. And then what it is numbers dot push I plus 1.
Okay. So I think from the last time we did this, you clarified to me that the const, like, declaration keyword, I'm not sure we would call that, but it just means that you can't assign something to the variable that's named. But you can mutate the value or, like, the fields within it.
Yes, that is an excellent observation, and I'm glad that it stuck with you. See, you can learn.
I can be taught.
Yeah, so the fact that numbers is set to an empty array as a constant only means it cannot be recast. You can manipulate the array.
Right. So then the for loop looks like it's pretty standard, and it starts at 0, but we're incrementing it by 1 when we push it. So I'm going to guess that it is 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay.
I'll let in an array.
You're going to be so mad.
Oh, God.
This one's dirty. And listeners, you don't know what the problem is. I just spotted it. And now I understand why it's called the eagle eye test. So we read off the code to
hold on.
Yeah.
Let me look again.
Take a second there. So the return of numbers is going to be an empty array. That's my guess.
Okay.
Why would I guess it's going to be an empty array? This is dirty. This is downright mean. This should not even be like a simple but tricky interview question.
Oh god, I see it.
Do you see it?
There's a semicolon after the four.
Yep. Yeah.
Oh.
The for loop has a malformed expression, so after the parentheses but before your curly brace, they stuck a semicolon in there which terminates the deal. Oh. So the following code never runs.
That's mean.
So, oh.
I mean, no, it's fair, like, I mean, with JavaScript or even PHP.
I'm wrong.
You know.
I'm wrong. The answer is an array with a single entry of 5.
Oh, wait.
It's a, yeah, can you figure out why without the...
Because, wait, but doesn't I fall out of scope after the for loop is ended?
You would think that, wouldn't you? What did we just go over in that if statement in the first question about
B? Yeah, like, it presumes it. But it's being declared as a var, though. So it's declared as a local variable to that scope, isn't it?
It... No.
What?
No. I mean, by default, yes. Let me rephrase that. Yes, it is being declared with var. But var? That's the difference between var and let.
Oh, var is a global variable.
If you let I equal 0 instead of var I equal 0, yes. The I ends up being scoped to the window. Var declares it globally. So we were correct in that nothing happens on the push in that for loop because of that semicolon. But what does happen is the for executes. So the for fires, but all that's happening is it's just looping through I until I equals 4, and then it quits.
Right.
But now I equals 4 at the window scope, and the curly brackets basically create the equivalent of just an anonymous function that runs that says numbers dot push 4 + 1.
All right. So if you did either for I equals 0, I less than length, et cetera, or for let I equals 0, I is less than length, or for var I equals 0, two of those three cases, I is going to be inferred to be a global, right?
I think to what you just said, yes.
Oh, wow.
But that's why we like using let so much.
I guess so.
Because lets you control that scoping a lot better. And I actually will go back. I said numbers would be, I still would have said numbers should have been empty. I would have said the follow up, and the reason why it was empty was because that semicolon would throw like an exception or something. So, like, it's not just ignoring it or whatever. Like, it would actively throw an error, but it doesn't. It does run, and it results in 4 + 1. So, an array length 1 with index 0 being 5. That one, okay. So, that's the first one that got us.
Jeez. I like in the comment, he says, I asked the interviewer, it was from a job interview. It's where this came up for him. And he says, ask the interviewer, what is the reason behind dirty tricks like this? And the interviewer replied, because we need people that have good attention to detail.
Oh, yeah, that's terrible. Yeah. Well, you know what? That's funny that you saw that and just read it. Because what did I just say about, like, this is not an interview quote. Like, this is a bad interview question.
That's shitty.
Because it is a trick. It is absolutely a trick. Yeah, I don't like that. Good on him for not going through with that company because...
I think if you're going to, like, in an interview, like, you get, like, basically one shot to get it right. But in the real world, like, you know, you would run this and it'd be like, oh, that's not working. Why is it not working? And then you look at it like, oh, semicolon, duh.
Yeah. And it would.
And then you fix
it. And it would take you 5 minutes to catch that and maybe take care of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I hate the name of the next one already. It's called automatic semicolon insertion. Which immediately makes me look at what this code is doing and be suspicious.
Right, right.
So we have a function, array from value, and it takes an attribute item. Takes an argument item.
And then it does return, and then there's a carriage return, and then brackets item, brackets semicolon. From the title, I'm going to infer that because return and item are on separate lines, that there is an inferred or presumed semicolon on the return statement, and maybe it's undefined?
I agree with you.
Okay.
I think the return is undefined for that. Yeah, for that exact reason. I think at the end of the day, because I know I've ran into this with JavaScript and stuff when I'm writing. It's like I don't have to put semicolons in. The end of a line is a presumed semicolon on those things, unless you like are doing nested if, you know, you can do if statements and stuff that are like single expression type deals. But yeah, I think what's happening here, because as soon as the return fires, then it doesn't ever even do anything with the item array that gets returned. And the answer is undefined. For exactly what we said. So it automatically interpolates a semicolon after the return. That means the function is done. The fact that they put the item argument inside an array is irrelevant, does nothing, and is effectively thrown out.
I never would have gotten that one if it wasn't for the title.
Yeah, the title definitely was a clue on that one.
Yeah.
Especially because it was short. That was a pretty short example. So it's not like there was a lot of places to look. The indenting also makes it look funny the way they did it.
Right.
Okay. The classic question. A tricky closure. Okay. Now, we've talked about closures before.
Yes.
And about the availability of variables after something has ran.
Right.
So we have a let I. So this time, what do we know about I?
Okay. So I is defined as like scope limited, right? Because it's let. So it's limited to only the scope of whatever this block is executing in.
Yes.
And then you have a for statement, and it's I equals 0, I is less than 3, I plus plus. And within the block for that, it does const log equals. And then I believe this is the new syntax for an anonymous function, right?
That returns a value, or doesn't. Right. So in this case, the console.log is like an implicit return.
Yeah, so it's const log equals empty parens, hash rocket, and then curly braces, console.log, I, close braces, and then set timeout, log, comma, 100. Jesus. Okay.
I equals 0, I 3, I plus plus. So the obvious answer is that it would log 1, 2, 3. Right?
That's what like they want you to think. Yeah.
Or rather 0, 1, 2.
That's what the man wants you to think, Michael.
Well, yeah, so we can assume that it's not that.
Yeah.
I
kind of wonder if, like, you know how in CSS, like, there's a different stacking indices for z-index? Like, if you do regular static content versus floating something versus position absolute.
Yeah.
I kind of wonder if the anonymous function, if doing a closure here, creates a different scope, and because it's I is defined with a let statement, that means that it's not available in the closure scope.
Yeah,
I'm really pulling from thin air here.
No, you're actually I think I'm
probably right though.
I think you're on the right track there. So what do you think the answer is? Let's start with that.
Okay, yeah, it's a good question. I'm going to say maybe undefined three times.
Okay.
Or whatever console.log undefined would be.
Okay. Yeah, so I mean that would be undefined is what you get in that situation. You do you sneak a look over my shoulder? Are you concerned that maybe you don't fully get what's happening? Or are you going to stick with that answer?
What was your answer?
My answer is 333.
Okay, so I just looked at the actual answer while you were talking. I'm still going to stick with mine because I hate your answer.
Am I right?
So
I must be right.
You are correct. Yes. Okay, wait, you got to tell me why, though, man.
Okay.
This is messed up.
No, it's not. It's one of those things, like, it's weird, but it does make sense. Because we're talking about closures, right? And how, you know, the availability of variables outside of their function calls and things like that. So think about what's happening. First, we let I. So the I variable is declared inside of whatever block this is. Maybe it's a window, maybe it's some other function, we don't know. But we know that it is declared before the for loop. So that means it's available outside of the for loop.
Mm-hmm.
What is the for loop doing?
This has got me thinking about, like, is there like a process stack or something?
Kind of, yes.
Yeah, is it like a different thread for closures?
So think of it like this.
Like, is the for, I guess what I'm asking is, like, is the for loop completely resolving before the anonymous functions actually execute?
Yes. Exactly.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because the for loop completes with a set timeout. And so it's saying, hey, in 100 milliseconds, run log. Log is the closure.
Right.
Log is the thing that's available to you outside because it's been allocated by the for loop. But when the for loop originally runs its three times, it's creating const log. It's not executing what's in there. It's creating something you can reference. But that for loop, it does that three times to no consequence, except that I gets incremented. Then the set timeouts fire, 1, 2, 3. But each time, it's outside of the for loop that set timeout's running. And as a result, because I is scoped above 4, it's set to 3. Because just like the other loop that we looked at, where we end up with 5, right? Because that 4, you end up with the last value, and so you're acting on the last value. That's what's happening here. You're acting on the 3. So it's just a case of that log becomes a closure that you can reference outside of that scope because the for loop knew what it was. So you still have the memory reference there that you can call to.
I get it.
But only inside that. Like, you couldn't do that outside the for loop. If you put that set timeout outside your for loop, then it wouldn't work because it has no idea what log is.
Right. All right.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. You may not like it, but I mean, closures are nasty anyway. Like,
I mean, like, I get it, and I think at least I'm not mad that I got it wrong. Like, it seems like, okay, this, if I understood closures better, I would have seen this. So this is my own fault. It's fair.
Yeah, no, and this is actually a pretty nice and lightweight way of demonstrating how a closure works. Like, it's not very complex.
So if you did set timeout log, comma, like 1, then you might get into like a race condition, right? Because the console logs could be happening before or during the execution of the for loop.
That's possible. At any rate, that's that. Okay. Last two. We're in the home stretch. Floating point math. Oh, wait, we know this one.
Yeah, it's going to be false because it's like 0.300.
Yeah. So we'll walk through it anyway, just to see what you remember from the first episode.
Sure.
So 0.1 plus 0.2 equals 0.3. And so,
yeah, that's going to be false.
So yeah, it's it is a Boolean return there. So yeah, it's false. So why is it false?
Yeah, because 0.1 plus 0.2 is floating point math, and that comes out to being like 3 with a bunch of zeros and then a 4.
Yeah. Yeah, so this comes back to this notion that we're doing math with lightning we've trapped inside a bit of sand that we have compressed. And so there are some rounding issues. Fun fact on this quiz, though, he links to a site. I love it. It's 0.300000, a bunch of zeros, 4.com. I'll link it in the show notes or something. But they made a site that is literally the result of that example and share it to explain why that happens. So that's kind of neat, actually.
Oh, interesting. In base 2, in binary, the only prime factor is 2, so you can only cleanly express fractions whose denominator has only 2 as a prime factor. So 1 over 2, 1 over 4, 1 over 8 would all be expressed cleanly as decimals, while 1/5 or 1/10 would be repeating decimals. So 0.1 to 0.2, 1/10 and 1/5, while clean decimals in a base 10 system are repeating decimals in base 2, when you perform math on these repeating decimals, you end up with leftovers to carry over and you convert computer's binary number into a human readable base 10 representation.
Wow. That's a dense explanation that basically means, hey, we have math being done by lightning inside a piece of silicone.
Yeah.
It is interesting, though. This is a very computer science problem. And I think we talked about that last time that, like, this is not unique to JavaScript. This is a language problem in general. And it's pretty interesting to think that in 2022, we still have not, like, solved the floating point problem, you know, because of the way we store data. That's
going to come back and bite us at some point, I'm sure, right? Like, it's going to be like a new Y2K thing. Once we get past the end of C time, when the Unix epoch ends, then the next thing will be like getting bitten by floating point math.
Yeah, it'll be something for sure. And it goes back to this idea of like how we do math with money, right? Like we convert everything to cents first, then do all of our math, then convert it back to make sure we don't get the Superman 3 rounding worm error, or Office Space if you prefer that one. Well, crap, that's short-circuiting us to the last question, though we're coming up on time here, so... and we get a hoisting question.
Oh, great. Okay. What happens if you access myvar and myconst before declaration? So if you have myvar and then myconst, and then later on, var myvar equals string value, and const myconst equals 3.14 as a floating point number. All right, because it's called hoisting, I'm going to assume that, well, I mean, if you just type the numbers, I guess it would echo back the result.
Yeah. In this case, the thing of it, like you're using it in a terminal or it's got console log wrapped around it.
Sure. So I'm going to guess that you'll see value and then 3.14. I don't think you should, though. I think that it should show you undefined for both. That's what I think should happen.
I think this one's trickier than they're letting on. I'm actually going to go with both of them being undefined.
Okay.
Which feels wrong, because that feels like the obvious answer. But my reasoning is, and this is where, let's see if I can humiliate myself by totally describing hoisting wrong. Hoisting works with, like, functions and things like that, but not with a variable declaration. So if the variable, like, if var, my var, is not set before you try to call my var, then it comes back undefined. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to assume that the same is I'll reverse. I think my var is undefined. I think my const is 3.14. I think the constant gets hoisted because it's a constant, but the variable doesn't because it's using the var declaration and is after you try to call the variable. That's what I'm thinking. Does that sound like I know what I'm talking about? Because I definitely don't this time. So it's whether or not you want to trust me.
That sounds dubious. I think I'll take one for the team here. I'm going to say undefined for
both. Undefined for both.
That's what I want it to be. So I'm going to say that that's what the answer is.
Oh no.
Are we both wrong?
I don't know, but they just threw a phrase at me I don't recognize. So they say hoisting
is the phrase and important concepts.
Temporal dead zones.
Temporal dead zones. What?
I've never heard of a temporal dead zone. Okay. Okay, so but here's the thing. There is a difference between let and const and var in all of this. So they have a little kind of graphic here.
Whoa.
Wait.
So I was half right.
Wait. So accessing my var before declaration evaluates to undefined. A hoisted var variable before its initialization has an undefined value. So it exists, but it isn't set yet. So yes, so we were both right with my var. However, accessing my const before the declaration line throws a reference error. Const variables are in a temporal dead zone until the declaration line. Interesting. So I was, we were both like half right, half wrong. You were half right on the undefined. I was half right that the const behaves differently and that var does not, the value of var does not get hoisted up.
Right.
Wow, temporal dead zone. That's interesting. I've not that
seems like some bullshit, man.
I'll have to look that up and see if that's a new thing out there or what. There is a link here that we'll share too that from Dimitri's own stuff that gets into variable hoisting and all of the sort of stuff that goes along with that. Because that's another thing that similar to like closures can be a little difficult to grasp, but is very good to learn for a whole lot of reasons.
Right.
Okay. That wasn't that bad.
Those were actually a couple
trickies.
I mean, they were dirty, but I'll give you that these were good.
There was one that was dirty. The semicolon one was dirty. The rest of them were what they were.
I don't know. I think the other one was a little dirty too. But the automatic semicolon insertion.
Oh, yeah.
That one, I wouldn't have guessed that because JavaScript is so loosey goosey about white space normally, right?
Yeah, and it's gotten weirder now that we have, you know, ES6 and all of this and TypeScript and all of that where you can go without semicolons. I am a pro semicolon person. I just am. Like, that's just kind of the way that I learn stuff, and I like the sort of finality it gives to your statements when you're scanning them. What was the hardest question here as far as, like, something that seemed fair to you? Like,
the tricky closure one.
The tricky closure.
That was a legitimately good, like, that would be, if I had to be given a question on an interview that was challenging, that would be a good one to give.
Because that one
felt like a puzzle. It didn't feel like a bullshit question, you know?
I'll say that I kind of like that very first question, actually, when it comes to the let A equal B equal zero. Just because of, like, it helps you understand the difference between let and var. And what happens when you reference a variable like B that hasn't been defined yet, but inside an expression. And so what happens there? Like, the behavior of those variables, I think, is another good... I think I like that. That was a nice...
Yeah. I mean, that was okay. That wasn't my least favorite one on there. Yeah.
I really enjoyed... This is the last episode of this run we're going to do, so if you're getting tired of hearing us go through these kind of things, don't fret. We will be changing pace in the next episode. I enjoyed this simply because I like the exercise of it. I think there's a lot of value in sitting down and, like, whatever language you're proficient in, go look up posts.
I would agree with that. I mean, I clearly learned something. Like, I knew the one thing about the, what was the thing with the const, right? With the array. Even though it ended up not mattering because it was a bullshit question. Yeah.
But
I remembered that, though.
And you know what what I think it really does, too? Because I have an example of this that, like, hit me a few years back was the first time I found out about JavaScript short-circuiting.
What?
So there's a way of doing things like you can use the logical and or the logical or operators to put up a statement that will be one single line and it will do things. So you could say something like, if you said, you know, let X equal 1, and then you could do something like console.log, whatever the variable name I just said was, number or X. Let console log, you could say X or nothing, like the word nothing or something. And what it would do is say, if X is set, then I'm going to show that. If it isn't, then I'm going to say nothing. And so it's just a way, or like a ternary operator, right? You've got ternaries in Ruby, don't you?
Oh, okay. What you're calling short-circuiting, we call it, depending on how you want to use it, it's either like memoizing or it's like fall through.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there was a question that was like this in the Ruby episode that you gave me about like true and false, you know? So what happens then? Yeah. But like, to look at like a lot of code written with things like short circuits or ternary operators, a ternary operator is just basically a way of doing an if else then all in one simple line without a bunch of statements and brackets and all of that.
Right.
So like the way you start learning about those kind of tricks, at least the way I learn about those kind of tricks, is to take things like this little quiz and start testing myself and see, what do I get right? What do I get wrong? What do I need to look more at? And then eventually you hit one of those, it's like, it's going to throw something at you you don't know. And that's how I found out about the short circuiting and what it was called. I didn't even know it was a thing. But I saw some code like that, and I'm like, trying to understand, what is this thing doing here when it's, you know, how does it know that it should run this function based on what the statement is? And it's just a case of the way, you know, flow through happens on those expressions, that it's like, it's basically just saying, if the left hand is true, then do the right hand. Or if the left hand is false, then do the right hand. And so you take what is three lines of code and make it one line. So it's efficiency.
Right.
It's, you know, these are the things, and these start to stand out then when you go do your code interviews or developer interviews at other companies, when you can demonstrate that kind of efficiency. And the word that I like to use now, idioms, right? That's an idiom of the language that shows that you grasp more advanced concepts than a simple if else, you know, follow through. If else.
I think that
or else if,
rather. I think that learning language idioms, I think, is really important, regardless of what language you're doing. I know that at a previous job, I was trying to update some React code, and I like really like it was ugly. I mean, it more or less worked, but it was very ugly. And I was asking one of my coworkers for a review, and he said, like, he audibly laughed because my JavaScript was dripping with Ruby. And I've definitely seen the same thing when like JavaScript programmers come over to Ruby for the first time. There's all these like idiomatic things that they do, or Java programmers or PHP programmers. Like, everyone has their own little like habits and idioms that they learn from their like, I don't like native language, but like primary language or like former primary. It's sometimes it's fun to play like spot the idiom and look at like how they're writing and something in the language you do and being like, I think you're coming from a PHP background, am I right?
Well, and I think it makes a difference, just like what we've done these last three episodes, you know, knowing some of the idioms the way I do, while I didn't necessarily use the right words and stuff in some of the Ruby stuff, like, I was able to kind of suss out some of those behaviors. And even though the behaviors were a little different in some cases or whatnot, like, you'll become surprised at how not different some of this stuff actually is, or how at least easy it is once you realize what it is they're doing. You may not like it.
Yeah.
It may bug the hell out of you, but it does get easy to pick up on real fast.
At my current job, I am working on an app that involves some Golang stuff, and Go is an interesting language, but I haven't had any training on it at all. Everything I've learned from it, I've picked up from my coworker and just like studying it myself. And I can get through it. Like I can read something and follow a path and get a rough idea of like where something would need to be changed. But the thing that I found is like, you can, when you have enough experience as a programmer, you can look at any kind of program and be like, okay, I more or less
can, yeah, mostly understand how it works.
I mean, maybe not going to like assembler or something, but you know, like if it's any kind of like standard flow program, you can pretty much 100%. Figure it out. But writing it though, that's where, you just have to learn the idioms. And I think that's really important. I think that like idioms are what they are because they play to the strengths of the language, and it's like an emergent property from many, many people writing it.
It's a very nice way of and putting it, actually.
Yeah. It's
very complimentary of you, given how much you don't like JavaScript. So I think that's a good note to end on. I'm going to run.
I really hate being the guy that's like, oh, your language sucks. And I know that it's just that like I'm used to a different one. And I apologize to all of our listeners that are like big fans of JavaScript. It doesn't sit well with me personally. And I know that I say mean things about it, but that's me like immaturely venting my frustration. So I am sorry.
And with that thought, we will take a quick break and be out of here. I hope you've enjoyed this journey with us as we embarrassed ourselves a few times, probably described some stuff wrong, but helped expose you to the thought process that goes behind problem solving and learning languages and all of that. And I think that is a worthwhile experience and use of time for what it's worth. And now I know a little bit more Ruby, too.
Yeah, congratulations.
And you know a little more JavaScript. You remembered how some of the stuff went, the floating point.
I will say I legitimately learned stuff, like TIL and I guess last week IL as well. So you can come and talk to us about all of your favorite programming idioms at Facebook and Twitter.com/DrunkenUX or Instagram.com/DrunkenUXPodcast. And come and talk with us and really tell me how much I've hurt your feelings with all of my JavaScript bashing.
Jeez.
I'm so sorry. chunkinux.com/discord. And please come and help us get transcripts made up. chunkinux.com/support.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Or just patreon.com/chunkinux.
Yes, either one works.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And we've got a new change of pace coming up, I assure you, on that. This has been fun, but it's time to get back to other stuff. I hope you pay attention to the WordPress news and what's happy and exciting going on there. We've mentioned both Aaron and I have open positions at our company for web developers. If anybody wants to come and join us or look into what we're doing, links are in the show notes to all of that, and you can certainly reach out and ask us any questions. We would be happy to help, and please apply. We'd love to talk
actually,
to you.
Actually, I know a few other places that are also hiring. So if you are looking for work, please reach out to both of us. In addition to my company, if that isn't the right fit
That is
for
one
you,
of those high, like, networking sort of values of, like, getting to know people. Yeah, we always know somebody, especially right now. Right now is a good developer designer market, so there's a lot out there, and it always helps having somebody who can, you know, point you in a direction.
Definitely.
With that, I guess all I can say is learn your idioms. Go take some tests. Figure out what you can do and, you know, what makes sense.
Wait. Keep your languages close, but your idioms closer.
Oh, I guess I'll let you do that.
I get
you
one.
You got me.
5 seasons in. I get one, finally.
Folks, bye-bye.
Bye.